You're listening to Better Fishing with Two Bald Biologists, sponsored by the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. I'm Corey Oakley, the Assistant Chief of Fisheries Management for the Inland Fisheries Division.
And I'm Ben Ricks, Coastal Region Fisheries Supervisor.
We are fisheries biologists who are avid anglers. We want to link the work we do as biologists to your fishing. Our goal in this podcast is to use the information we have as an agency to help you catch more fish and learn about our state's great aquatic natural resources.
All right, guys, here we are again. Appreciate y'all tuning in. It's been a lot of fun. You guys have sent us a lot of questions, had a lot of participation in the expos lately. So
yeah,
it's good.
It's been good.
By the time this one airs, we will have done the Mid-Atlantic.
That's right. By the time this one airs.
In Greenville, North Carolina. So thank you in advance for those of you who showed up and talked to us. How about that? Even though it hasn't happened yet.
Future.
I'm speaking into the future.
There you go.
So how are things, Corey?
Going well.
Good.
Plan to go fishing on Friday. If the weather holds out.
Good on you.
I'm excited.
The weather did not hold out on Saturday.
No. Did you go anywhere?
I still snuck out.
Ah, there you go. I hear
you. We caught some fish and we're home well in time to eat lunch because of how bad the weather was.
Yeah, so, it rained pretty good on Saturday.
Yes, it was the proverbial frog choker.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Plan to go white bass fishing on Friday with my boy. So. Should be good.
It is that time.
It is that time.
Spring has sprung.
Thank goodness.
That is what we're going to be talking about today is yet another spring fishery, which is the shad fishing. And we've got a good biologist here to talk about it. We got David Belkoski. David, why don't you introduce yourself to the group?
How's it going, guys? My name's David. I'm the D3 biologist. So we sample from the Triangle Lakes all the way up to Lake Gaston. And in the spring, we get to hang out on the Tar River, which is awesome. It's a sweet river, and March is a great time to get out there. If you're listening to this right now, go to the Tar River. Get out there. There's fish.
So we actually steal David for part of the year at the coast. He's normally, his district is in the Piedmont, but we say, hey.
Come help.
Come help.
Come do this.
So somehow David and his counterpart get the glories of being both a coastal region district and a Piedmont region district.
We get the best of both worlds. I get to see big bass in Harris and Falls, and then in the spring, I get to see anadromous fish coming up those coastal rivers, and it's a good mix of fish species. It keeps everything really exciting.
I like that you say that you get the best of both worlds, because you could have a different attitude about
that. The worst.
You could say,
your perspective for sure.
We drew the shortest of straws.
Yes.
You know. So, but no, they do a great job. They really help the coastal staff out a lot because we have three districts and four major rivers. So if you're paying attention and moderately good at math, you realize that those numbers don't really work out very well. So we're blessed in the coast that David and Kurt can come and help us out.
They actually have two of the coastal rivers in their district. They have
three.
Technically, three spawning grounds.
Yeah, they got the spawning grounds of three coastal rivers in their district. So we could say that David and Kirk should do all three, and that'd free up your staff.
Or maybe we're helping them out.
Exactly. So you've been looking at it wrong all along, Ben. You're actually helping them out.
Right.
So that's,
we're sampling.
That's very good of you, Ben.
They're spawning.
That's very good of you, Ben.
So you're welcome for that.
Oh, man. Right. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
We don't have enough on our plate.
Right. Yeah. No, it would be a nightmare if you did have to be all three places at once.
Spring gets pretty wild, and yeah, all hands help.
So, those of you who don't know, normally the way our spring anadromous or migratory fish runs go is we start with herring, which is about right now. That rolls quickly into American shad, which normally that's gearing up towards the end to the first part of April. The American shad actually stay through, you know, Memorial Day. And then somewhere probably mid-April, our striped bass sampling really picks up. So
you forgot hickories.
Well, we don't really sample hickories.
Oh, that's true. We don't. But they're there.
Yeah, they're there. Their stocks are doing good. We'll inevitably probably wind up talking about hickory shad today on this podcast, even though we're trying to be American shad-centric. But hickories show up about the same time.
Man, why are we hating on hickory shad? They fun to catch.
We're not hating on them.
Okay, I'm just
we're just stretched in so many different directions. And we do glean hickory shad data during our other projects.
Mm-hmm.
So a a lot of times we'll see hickory shad while we're doing our herring work. We'll see hickory shad when we're doing the American shad surveys. We just don't have a targeted effort towards those. And in part because those stocks are healthy and doing well, and, you know, we're able to kind of
seem to be very robust,
sneak a look at them just enough with our other efforts that no problems are looming with their catch rates, which is great.
Yeah, a win for us.
Yeah. One less thing to worry about.
Yeah, a win for us.
So tell us a little bit about your background. Where'd you go to grad school?
I went to Wilmington, UNC Wilmington, was studying coastal rivers for flathead and blue catfish stomach contents. Really smelly work, but also fun. You get to see a lot of big fish. Also eating shad.
You studied eating shad?
No, I studied the fish that eat shad.
Oh, okay.
Get to see live fish and you get to see digested fish.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Virginia. Grew up fishing the Potomac River for shad with my grandfather. Spring, you got to get out there. And so we fish for them up at Fletcher's Boathouse up by D.C. I got a good shad run on the Potomac and then came down to North Carolina for my master's. Stayed at Auburn for a little bit, you know, just like you did, Ben. Studying some fish stuff there, mostly black bass, biodiversity and range expansion. And yeah, now I'm here on the coastal rivers and outside of Raleigh.
No, that's great. So you brought something up. There's shad on the Potomac. There's shad in the tar, the noose, the Cape Fear, the Roanoke. Where's the top of the shad and the bottom of the shad if they're in all these places?
If you are on the East Coast, there are shad. So there are shad all the way from Florida all the way up to Maine. That's the cool part about them is their life history is really dynamic. They hang out on the East Coast of Maine, up in the Bay of Fundy in Canada most of the year. And then they come down to their home rivers where they were spawned and born. And every year they come back to the same river, whether that's St. John's, Florida, or whether that's the Tar River, North Carolina, or Potomac in Virginia and Maryland. So they cover the whole East Coast. And if you're on the coast, you got a shot at one.
I have told you guys, and Corey has said the same thing. I became a fish biologist because I wanted to catch more fish.
Yeah. Selfish of us.
Yeah, totally selfish of us. And it did work. I do catch a lot of fish on occasion. So.
You're better at it than I am. I'll give you, yeah. I'm better at it than I used to be.
When I get
sure.
some time to go, I know yeah. I can figure out where to look
That's
on
right.
occasion. But when I really started developing my fish nerdiness, just the fact that I'm from the Roanoke River, grew up fishing, welding, and that whole area, I got really interested in, well, if I could learn more about these fish, maybe I could catch more of them. And when I started reading into shad and figuring out what they were doing, that's really when the fish nerd hooked into me.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's very impressive that these fish from, I don't know, hundreds of different rivers could all be milling around in the Bay of Fundy off the coast of Maine, doing their shad thing out there. And then all of a sudden, a slight water temperature change, and they all go back
to
wherever they were born.
Yeah.
With 98% fidelity to where they were born. So very little straying, and they know exactly where to go, and they do it for about 5 to 10 years, depending on where they're at and how taxing that migration is on them. You know, the further south they go, they normally don't repeat spawn, and the further north you go, the more they spawn multiple years. That's primarily due to how bad that migration taxes them, and then the stress of the water temperature in those rivers.
So what you're saying is if you're a Florida shad, you're probably going to go one time, spawn, and die.
Pretty much.
If you're a Maine shad, you might spawn every year.
You might spawn for seven, eight, ten years.
Yeah.
So
those Florida shad live a tough life.
Right.
Got a lot of mouths to get by and a lot of lures to get by.
And a distance.
And they go a long way.
Yeah. So the other side of that is if you're talking about life cycle of the fish and you want to catch a trophy American shad, you probably need to buy a bus ticket north. So.
Or you could fish south to north. Catch them all because the spawning time is later up north, so you got chances all spring.
Right.
Just gotta head north.
And we do have a few guys who are big time shad buffs, you know, they want to be the first guy to catch a shad and that kind of thing. But yeah, you could start as early as probably February, maybe even late January in Florida.
Yeah.
And then by June still be catching them, June, July, maybe even still catching them up in Maine. So it's pretty wild that that fishery kind of slides the way that it does.
It's cool life history for sure.
They're fascinating fish to me. And there's not just American shad that do it. Tell us what else does it, David.
That's right. Hickory shad we talked about earlier. Both of the river herrings do it. They all are plankton eaters. So they go out into the ocean and they filter through some plankton, get big and fat in the Bay of Fundy, and then river herrings show up first. Generally, the hickory shad show up after them, and then American shad are last, and then they're tailed by a bunch of big striped bass.
So just because you said it, you said both of the river heron. This isn't a river heron podcast, but we can't leave both hanging out there.
We lump the river herrings together, alewife and blueback herrings, because they look really similar, and they're kind of in a complex together. They do the same things, but they're both really valuable fish to have in the fishery.
Right. And if you want to know more about river herring, we did a podcast about a year ago this time.
About a year ago. Yep.
And we talked with Chris Smith, another great biologist, and we talked with him about herring and herring management and the trends we've seen over time. So roll back a little bit and listen to that one if you're interested in that. But today,
yeah,
shaddy poos.
Yeah. And David just mentioned it. I think one of the key components that people need to remember is that their life history is this way, but they all depend on each other in some ways or some fashion. I mean, at least the striped bass really depend on river herring and shads for that matter, because they're coming up to spawn too, but they're using those shad and river herring as forage as they're coming into the river to spawn. And then their babies are using the baby shad and the baby herring that come out of the rivers at the same time. They're using them to feed on to make their babies survive. So it's all a part of it. And if something's off, which right now some things are off in the coastal plain, when something's off, then everything kind of goes off. So river herring's been off for a long period of time, and now we're seeing striped bass that are off. And when I say off, they're just not doing as well as we want them to do. And so it's all connected, and it's meant to be that way.
Right.
And that's what's cool about the spring fishery too, is, you know, they all are kind of coming in the same order. The river's kind of waking up and new fish are coming in. They're keying off each other and using each other. And that should be you to get up off of the couch and go try and catch one.
Right. And David, I just wanted to make the point that David said, like, well, first is this and then it's this. And I even said that. But really, it's this gradient, you know.
Yeah.
So there's an overlap. So you can catch a heron while you're hickory shad fishing.
That's right.
You can catch an American shad or white shad is what a lot of local folks call them.
Yeah.
While you're hickory shad fishing, you can catch striped bass while you're, you know, there's this overlap where you can catch anything at any time. And because of that, it's important to know the difference. And so, David, I know, you know, maybe we can post some pictures, but right now for our listeners, could you describe the difference as best you can between each of these fish so that our listeners, because we don't want you getting a blue light special.
Try to prevent those.
Yeah. So we'll use this as a moment to kind of talk about the difference between these species. Obviously, a striped bass is different.
Yeah, you should know striped bass versus a shad.
They'll stand out.
Let's hope that one stands out from the other
and
four.
And if you don't know, a little Googling will get you there right quick.
That's right.
So
the herring are the easiest because they're small. When the hickory and American shad show up, we know they're at least 2 to 3 years old. So they generally come back pretty grown. But the herring, they're going to be a little bit smaller and, you know, 6 to 8 inches are going to be your herring. They all look really similar. They're all in the same family. So it is really hard to tell the difference if you haven't caught any. Hickory shad, they have a different mouth than American shad. They have a really upturned mouth. The bottom of their jaw goes all the way up to the top of the face. Kind of got an underbite. Obvious if you see a hickory next to an American.
To me, it's that underbite when you're talking about American versus hickory shad. That hickory shad, that bottom jaw really sticks out far. So to me, if you're wondering which is which, just look at that bottom jaw.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can be the same size. Even though American shad do get bigger than hickories overall, they can be the same size. So you need to make sure you know what you're looking at, particularly if you're going to keep it.
Right. And Dave, you can comment on this. You've measured more than I have in the last year or so, but a really big herring is like 12, 13 inches. And
yeah,
a really small hickory shad is like 12, 13 inches.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot of overlap between those two lengthwise.
That's so, right.
if you catch one and you think it's a small hickory shad, might not want to keep that one.
Just if you have any question about it, maybe just let it go.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're catching hickory shad, odds are you'll catch more than one.
And the reason for that is there's different rules and regulations depending on the river's systems and all that stuff. And you can't keep river herring anywhere. So truth. You don't want to keep a river herring at all right now. So that's why we're telling you, you know, if you're confused between what a river herring is and a small hickory shad is, probably best to let that fish back in the water.
Right.
There's plenty of hickory shad out there that are bigger.
There's different shad rules.
That's
They're
right.
all aggregate. So you can keep 10 on every river, but you need to look up what is the specific rule for your area.
That's right.
To make sure that you're not keeping more American shad than you're allowed. So double check that before you go out.
Aggregate means the combination of hickory and American shad.
Can be 10.
Mm-hmm.
But the composition can change depending on what river you're on.
Right.
Are right. you thoroughly confused, folks?
If you have questions, you can email us.
Call us, write us.
At twoballbiologist@ncwildlife.org.
That's
and we'll
right.
be happy to
be
help
happy
you out.
Happy to help you out.
So, or send you to David or Chris or any of the other guys that it's in their wheelhouse.
That's right.
To be honest, I'll probably handle it because they're busy on the shock boat right now.
Yeah.
But we'll get you right. So if you have any questions, call us at any time or email us and we'll help you out.
So I know it's Shad Podcast, but explain the difference between what a blueback and alewife looks like, which is even harder.
It is. It is. The alewife, the old timers around here will call them old goggle eyes. They'll have a bigger eye and a bit of a squarer or blockier head versus the blueback heron will have a pointier nose and a slightly smaller eye. You can also cut them open, which we wouldn't recommend because their inner cavity is different. One is white on the inside, the other one's black on the inside, but that's not a good way to find out. The best way...
That's a blue light special.
Yeah. The best way is to look at their head shape, and you really got to have like one of each beside because it can be a little misleading. Also, and I'm going to go ahead and take a little bit of a blame for this because we've put out some literature that talks about spots.
Please throw that literature in the trash can.
The spot determination is really, for me, I mean, it's not wrong information. It's just hard because there's so much variation in spots and there's so much variation between different fish and among different fish that sometimes you can see three spots, sometimes you can see five spots, sometimes you can see one spot. And so the spot count, just throw that technique out. Because it's iffy at best, and it's definitely not a sure thing when you're IDing those fish. So,
that's right.
Using color alone is tough.
Yeah. So, sorry about that, guys. We didn't mean to confuse you.
Or you can be like me and go, that's a heron, throw it back.
You're 100% correct.
So, the other thing that most people, we talked about how they're eating big time in the Bay of Fundy, just getting fat and happy, you know.
Lots of plankton going in.
Once they get in the river, David, how much are they eating once they're in the river?
They're not eating anything. So they eat a little bit when they're staging up, but then when they're doing their spawning run, they're not feeding.
If I was at the Bay of Fundy and then came to North Carolina, I would lose weight. Maybe that's what I need to do.
Depends on how long you hibernated for, how good you fattened up over the winter.
Right. Well, I fattened up just fine. So... But that's the weird thing about is these fish are not, I mean, I don't want to say no, they don't feed, but as a general rule, they're not hitting baits because they're delicious. Why are they hitting these baits, David?
So they're pretty much, it's a reaction strike. They don't normally eat small fish. They're, like I said, they're plankton feeders, but the bigger they get, they can eat small shrimp or really small juvenile fish. But a lot of fish just have that, you know, the need to hit something that they see. And so if something flashes in front of them, they'll go for it and you get a reaction strike. It's the same way with salmon. They've stopped feeding, but you put something close enough to their mouth and it looks a little bit like something they're used to eating, they'll go for it whether they're hungry or not.
If you wave some chicken wings in front of me long enough, there will be less of them. That's all I'm saying.
And other food items. Yeah. It doesn't have to be chicken wings.
Yeah, it could be fried fish. We had some of them last week. It could be hamburgers, you know.
I've been known to eat a few things.
Yeah.
That's the crazy part is we're not throwing plankton lures. No, we're throwing actual fish lures. They're hitting them.
Yeah, I mean, a copepod is a very small
bait. A small bait. Almost, you can't see it. It's so small.
Right. Only the biggest ones can you even really barely see. But the cool thing about it is we're talking about a reaction strike, and I love crazy colors, and shad fishing is crazy color central.
Yeah. The brighter, the wilder, the better.
Really, we don't have a whole, aside from maybe the Roanoke at Weldon, and even then it depends on the current rainfall pattern that we're in, but that water's clear, but the tar's fairly muddy, Noose is fairly muddy, Cape Fear can be clear, but it also it's can be muddy. Fairly muddy.
Yeah.
So while the white works on at Weldon very well, white and pink is one of my favorite colors growing up. But once you get on these muddier rivers, you get to throw hot pink, chartreuse.
Bright orange.
A wise man once said.
Lime green.
If it ain't chartreuse, it ain't no use.
That's Lefty Cray told me that one time. So
bright pink, bright green, white, anything that they can see and get close to them, they want to hit it.
And as a poor fly tire, it works out great because it doesn't have to be perfect.
No.
It just has to be an inch to 2 inches long.
And get in front of their face.
And brightly colored. Mm-hmm. And you just have to get it down there to them. So, yep. And that begs another question, David. What are the ways you grew up doing this? What are the ways to catch shad?
Unlike bass fishing, there's not 1,000 different lures that people throw. There's kind of just 3 main ones. There's shad dart, which is really just like a little cone that has a little hair on it. There's the crappie jig or a curly tail grub, whatever you want to call it, any different color. And then there's a spoon, just a normal small little shad spoon flickering silver in the water. Any combination of those 3 different color combinations, and you just figure out what they're hitting that day. Most people will throw tandem rigs. They'll put 2 different colors or 2 different lures, figuring out which one they're hitting, and then really hammer that one. It also could be your top or your bottom lure. Just figure out what they want based on where you are and how they're feeding.
Right. Normally, if you throw a tandem rig, normally, unless you like tangles, you need to put the spoon at the bottom of your tandem. So
you'll learn that quick. Why is this thing always coming back doubled over?
You can throw 2 jigs and then it doesn't matter. But yeah, if you're tying your own, and there also are shad rigs that are commercially available.
You can just use crappy jig. I mean, that's what I've done. Yeah. Just use crappy jigs.
A single crappy jig works just fine. Yeah. You don't need to mess with the double rigs if you don't want.
Unless you like catching them 2 at a time. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, ain't nothing wrong with catching 2 fish at the same time.
Right.
One of the things that I've noticed growing up fishing the Roanoke, where it's a ton of flow versus Pitch Kettle, Fishing Creek, some of the other places where there's less flow, is on the Roanoke, I used to put a giant egg sinker in front of my, and I was fishing fast and just trying to get my bait deep enough. And then when you go to these other rivers and shadfish and you show up with a 1/4-ounce egg sinker in front of your rig, you immediately lose that rig. Yeah. Because there's not near the flow that you need to do that. So you really have to pair what you're doing to the water that you're fishing.
Mm, the flow and the depth are huge.
Yeah. So almost always, and it really doesn't matter the size, but almost always these shad are nosing to the current, but associated with some sort of eddy.
Some seam, current seam.
It may be a current seam that you can see. It may be a hump on the bottom. It may be a tree. It may be a rock. It may be a bend in the river. But they're almost always sitting right on the edge of a current seam.
They're not afraid of that flow either.
No. Sometimes they'll be on the fast side of a current seam. The main thing what I've found is once you figure out what casts catch a fish, make that cast
over and over again
till it's time to go get you a hamburger or
something. Until your elbow hurts.
Right.
It's one of the few fisheries you can leave fish biting and walk away from.
Right.
They'll be there. I'm going to let somebody else catch these. I've had my fill.
That's the thing I would tell people. You know, I've done shad fishing in the past, done it not so far back in my past as well on the Roanoke some. But the one thing, you know, they're in pretty large groups, you know, in pretty large schools. Generally, when you find one, you're going to find a bunch.
And they spawn in aggregates.
They do. They spawn in aggregates.
And they're here to spawn.
And they're here to spawn, so that's what they're doing. I mean, me and two other fish biologists, we sat at Weldon one day just downstream of the boat ramp, and by lunchtime we had caught 300. We quit counting.
No.
And we were like, okay, it's time to go do something else. You know, and I mean, we didn't keep a one. It was just, it was good action. We had a good time doing it. I would tell people, if you're getting into fishing or you're getting a young person into fishing, this is an
fantastic,
this is an excellent time to take a young person fishing. Because
low investment, high reward.
Low investment. I mean, the gear is probably $10 to $20 worth of gear. You can stand on the bank. You don't have to be in a boat. And you can literally, if you find them and find the right cast, as Ben said, whatever that cast is, because it's whatever that drift is, you know, whenever you get a strike, okay, I'm going to throw back in that same spot and let it drift again until I get another strike. It can be very consistent for long periods of time. So, which is really good for young people. It keeps their attention and they get excited about catching fish. And if you use tandem rigs, you catch two at a time, which is ecstatic.
Even better.
And most people assume that we're talking about really tiny fish. When we say the word shad, everyone thinks of bait. And we're talking about
not thread fins or gizzards.
Yeah. No, these are big 3 to 5 pound fish.
Can be. Yeah.
You know, the big females, they get big. The state record on the tar is 7 pounds. So these are big fish. We most of the time
I've never seen a 7 pound shad. I would like to see one.
I would.
But
I would love to see one.
We're using ultralight gear with light line. It's a really good fight, especially because these fish are really strong swimmers. They hang out in the current. They look like little tarpon. They are just strong. They'll jump. They put on a show. And so you use ultralight and they'll put a hurting on you.
Yeah, you can use anything from probably a medium light to an ultralight. 10 to 6 pound test line is all you need. I talked about an egg sinker on the Roanoke where there's a faster current, but sometimes just maybe a split shot above your rig is all you might need.
Or just a heavier jig head.
Yeah, or nothing. It could just be a heavier jig or a heavier spoon is plenty.
And you're going to hang up. So
you might want to buy more than two.
There's a lot of laydowns in those coastal rifts.
You're
going
to hang up. You're going to lose a bait or two from time to time.
Most of our coastal rivers are not lacking for habitat.
No.
So in some shape or form.
And that's where the fish are.
So that's right.
Got to go there to catch them.
Yeah, there's something there making an eddy, and eventually you will catch whatever the eddy maker is.
Yep, that's right.
Let's talk about, I alluded to fly fishing a minute ago, but let's talk about fly fishing for them, because that's also a very popular thing. Little clousers, little deceivers, little spoon flies, any little kind of chenille type flies, brightly colored. That's really all you need.
It's too much work.
I mean, it does up the ante.
It
makes it a little bit more challenging, but still not so challenging that you can't be successful.
Yeah. And for those that love to do it, congratulations.
I have caught so many shad in my childhood. That's the one thing that I do fly fish for now. And I don't do it as much as I should, but it's a lot of fun. Anything between maybe a 6 and a 3 weight.
Yeah.
It's not the 3 weight that you go with Jake in the mountains. You know, you still need a 9 foot rod or so, because you need to make some decent casts and you need to let your line sink.
Yeah, these are big rivers. They're not the little creeks that Jake in the mountains looking for brook trout for.
Right. So you're going to want to make decent casts. Also, if you're using sinking line, a little bit heavier rod will help with that as well. I would say on the Roanoke, sinking line is probably a definite thing you'll need.
Must. Yep.
On the tar, the noose, probably the Cape Fear sinking line would be a must too, especially if you're below the locks fishing. But on the tar, you know, if you're in Fishing Creek, which is a well-known shad hole, probably don't need sinking line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot more subtle just because there's not as much flow. So we've talked about Fishing Creek a couple of times. Somebody's right now probably spinning because I'm giving out their secret spot.
Shush, Ben, shush.
It's not that much of a secret.
Yeah, a lot of people
know about it. It's well known. One thing I will say about shad anglers is if you go on social media and you look at the different fishing groups, some are more friendly than others.
Yeah.
Shad fishermen, as a general rule,
it's very social.
It's a very social fishing.
Yep.
They're very happy, you know, to
help
you out.
They're used to being shoulder to shoulder.
They're used to standing right beside each other below a bridge and fishing. I mean, it might be a little secretive, you know, at first, but once
there's also plenty of fish to go around.
Once the cat's out of the bag, it's come one, come all, let's enjoy it together. So at least that's my impression of shad fishermen as a general rule, is they're, you know, it's a communal thing. It's a lot of fun. The other cool thing about it is especially on the tar, there's boat ramps and there's bridges that provide a lot of different opportunities up and down the river. Talk a little bit about that, David.
Mm-hmm. So it is one of the classic fisheries in North Carolina. Shad will, like we said, they've come hundreds of miles from Maine, and they're not afraid to go as far as they can. So they're generally going to whatever the biggest dam or the nearest dam on the river is. And on the Tar River, that's Rocky Mount Mills, right in Rocky Mount. And so if you want to hit a time where there's a lot of fish all in the same area river, you can just go down below Rocky Mount Mills. They can't go above it, so they stack up below it, and you can get them almost like fish in a barrel. So Battle Park is a really good spot for them. We got a brand new boat ramp there that they were working on for the last year. It can get really flashy. You do want to check flows, but you know, there's a brand new boat ramp there. There's two new docks there that are good spots to catch shad from, and you can walk that entire bank. And if there's a guy in your spot, don't be afraid to just keep moving, walk that bank, and find an eddy that other people don't know about. There's rocks and there's trees underwater that you can't see, and there's eddies that you can't see that these fish are using as habitat. And so just walking the bank, going up and down, is a good way to find fish if you make the first couple casts and there's nothing there.
Right. We did say shoulder to shoulder, but
it's not quite shoulder to
shoulder. Be polite. You know, also, you know, a Weldon boat ramp is a great example of that.
That is shoulder to
shoulder. There's a lot of people that go, they fish there. Be aware of your back cast. Be aware of your surroundings. Don't hook anybody in the ear or face or anything else for that matter.
Yeah.
And be polite, you know. And if it's not shoulder to shoulder, maybe you don't need to be shoulder to shoulder.
That's right. There's about a 2-mile stretch up at Battle Park that you can walk the bank and catch fish from all over the place. So you're right. You don't need to buddy up that good.
Right. And one of the things I always tell folks is to think like a fish and not like a fisherman. What that means is if you see a fisherman or if you see an aggregate of boats, you don't necessarily have to get all in them. That just means there's fish in that area. You have to find somewhere similar to that. Maybe you can have a whole group of fish to yourself if you do it that way. So that's one of the things that I always tell folks. And yes, shad do aggregate kind of at the end of the roads, you know, at dams, fall lines, the rapids, things like that. But they also aggregate other places. So there's also a long stretch of river below Rocky Mount
that they're coming up
through. People catch shad in regularly. And it, you do have to kind of follow their movements, because it may be that at the first part of the run, they're lower in the river and you have to kind of follow them up. But also, there's also places that are stopovers. And it's very obvious to me on the noose and the sampling that we've done over the years on the noose that the fish either want to be in the Goldsboro area or they want to be in Raleigh, you know, and they really don't want to be anywhere in between. But there's a big stretch in Goldsboro where those fish could choose to go further upstream, but they don't. And so you can be very successful in Goldsboro. You can be very successful in Raleigh. And the crazy thing about the shad run in Raleigh is I run into people at Weldon, I run into people at Goldsboro, I run into people at Pitchkettle Creek, at Fishing Creek, and I ask them where they're from, and they say, I'm from Raleigh. And they don't even realize that one of the best kept shad fishing secrets is like 20 minutes from their house. Spoiler alert, there's plenty of shad close to you. If you live in the Piedmont, you don't have to go far away to catch
them. No, you don't at all. You know, I think back to my childhood, same as yours, Ben, same as yours, David. You know, the importance of the shad fishery, it was an important thing to so many people in the community. It wasn't as economically important as river herring was, but it was economically important and socially important to a lot of people in the east of Raleigh, basically. And I can remember as a child going to the boat ramp, and I lived in the New Bern area, and you go to the boat ramp, there'd be people lying down the bank, and they were fishing for shad.
And they still are.
And they still are to this day.
Right there, especially Spring Garden ramp.
Yep, Spring Garden boat ramp. It's kind of a little bit of a tighter spot. It's like a funnel.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fishing for shad back when they had nets, drift nets. I can remember people drift netting through that stretch there at Spring Garden, catching shad and herring. Back then, doing that. And so it's a very important fishery. It's very important to our state. A lot of people love to fish for them. I mean, this time of year on social media, people are like, I'm getting ready. It's time. Let's do this, you know, kind of thing with the shad run. And you can catch them all up and down the river, basically. You don't have to be at Battle Park in Rocky Mount. Yes, that is a congregating point because it's where they stop. But you don't have to be there on the Tar River. You can catch shad in Greenville. You can catch shad all along the river.
And they're also in these small tributaries.
Yeah, they'll be, you know. I mean, we talked about Fishing Creek. They go all the way to the dam. Was that Bellamy's Mill?
That's right. Now you're giving away secret spots. Yeah.
They go all the way to Bellamy's Mill Dam just outside of Rocky Mount on Fishing Creek. And they go all the way up Fishing Creek that far. And Pitchkettle Creek, I mean, Village Creek, you name all the creeks along the Neuse, Contentia Creek. There's shad somewhere in those systems.
The Trent River has
them.
Trent River's got shad. A secret hole. There's only the people that live on the Trent River really know about.
But it was very community oriented. People would go down there and fish. People would cook out. There would be all those kinds of things in my childhood that I remember about shad fishing. Now, my father could care less about a shad, so we didn't fish for a lot of shad when I was a kid. But, you know, I just remember that being a very important part of the fishery, and it still is to this day. And it's a great resource for the public. If you want to catch a fish in the springtime, it's almost a guarantee. Almost a guarantee if you go.
It's one of the few fish that still people talk about being able to walk across. There's so many fish in the river, you can walk across it.
And that's hickory shad. I mean, hickories are very abundant. I mean, you'll catch a lot of them.
Yeah. I mean, American shad are kind of the more, they're harder to catch.
They're more desirable because they get bigger.
Yeah. They're more of a trophy just to catch one. Like you may, a good, for me anyway, we'll say this. You can go and you can catch 80 to 100 hickory shad relatively easy at the right time in the right place. You know, a lot of the, just growing up in Roanoke Rapids, you know, American shad fishing, 8 would be a great day for me. Now, I know there's somebody listening right now that's been like, I got 38, and that's awesome. We all have our skills and talents, and, you know, I'm not good at everything. You can ask these guys.
You looked at me for a response. I didn't give
one. I baited him up, and he didn't take it.
That's, I didn't take it. I didn't take the bait.
That is personal growth, people. And David didn't take the bait either. So
I'm just let you keep talking.
But they are harder to catch. It is a little more subtle presentation. It's a little more refined to catch American shad over hickory, in my opinion. So just keep that in mind as you're fishing for them. You may catch.
But it was the one that everybody wanted to catch when I was a kid, because people called them roe shad when I was a kid, and they wanted to eat the roe out of them. That was the purpose of catching American shad. We called them white shad. We didn't I didn't even know they were American shad till I went to school.
Yeah, your people are white shad people.
Yeah, we're white shad people. That's what they called them. Or roe shad. A lot of people would call them roe shad. They wouldn't even call them white shad. And so that was exactly what they wanted them for. They wanted to get the roe out of them and eat the roe. Good luck. I mean, it's okay.
I've done it.
I've done it. It's not the worst.
It's a different texture than you're going to be used to.
Yeah.
If you put hot sauce and cheddar cheese in it in the right amount, it is just fine. And the right amount is pretty heavy, in my opinion. So I've had smoked shad, which is another very traditional to have them.
Yep.
That's even more strong, if you ask me. So
there are a lot of bones in those fish.
There's a lot of bones. They're very oily. They're exactly what you would think of a very large bait fish would be.
Right.
Of what a shad is, you know. So
they're not a flounder, grouper, bass. They're not a light.
If that's what you're trying to eat, do not try to eat that with a shad. That's not what you're going
to get. They have a strong fishy taste, and you just have to know that when you decide to eat one, is that it's not going to taste like something else. It's going to taste like a shad. And to me, if you know what it's supposed to taste like, you can enjoy it. But if you're eating it thinking it's supposed to taste like something else, you might be disappointed. It just depends. So,
but if you think back 100, even 500 years ago, when people were very much eating what was in front of them.
Right.
You know, America's changed a lot. The land has changed a lot. When they were eating what was in front of them, this was a very important food resource for people that lived in the coastal plain, whether they were Native Americans or whether they were Europeans that just settled here. It was a very important food source, and you didn't get to go, That's very fishy. I don't like that.
Right. No, well,
I mean, we've progressed where we can say that now.
Yeah, we're blessed that we can be picky.
That's right. You know? But back then you couldn't be, and you ate what was in front of you.
Well, you got to think about it. You're coming out of wintertime, and this is really the first real game in town that's
high,
not
high protein.
You know, so there's a lot of food just swimming up and down the rivers. And yeah, it was super important for a lot of people, a lot of different cultures in the country across time. So
they call them the founding fish for a reason. They're really, really used early on, and we still use them now.
Right. So you talked about how y'all called them white shad. We called them American shad growing up. And part of that...
Well, that's because you're from Virginia, kind of.
Well, but anyway. Almost, really. Almost.
It's close. It's close.
I'm not saying I'm from Virginia, from North Carolina people, but I'm close to the line. But the reason why we called them American shad and didn't adopt the more colloquial term growing up is because we didn't have them until the Wildlife Commission really started stocking them.
Yeah, they were gone.
In 98, I believe that was.
Yep.
Somewhere in the mid to late
97, 90s. 98, somewhere in that range.
It may have been a little few years before that.
Somewhere in that
range. But we had very few American shad in the Roanoke River. And so we started a stocking program to try to restore those fish. And there's definitely... We've talked about how there's no problem with shad. Man, the Roanoke, especially in terms of American shad, there may be some problems that we haven't figured out, because what we noticed was basically the proportion of hatchery fish over time. And we've talked about how we do that with genetics, and it's a real powerful tool in multiple other podcasts. Probably ought to have our geneticist on at some point and really go on a deep dive and make mine and Corey's brain hurt.
Maybe not. I like talking fish.
But our genetic evaluation is a real powerful tool. We can tell what year a fish was stocked, who its parents were, all that kind of stuff. And what we were seeing was those stocked fish, every year the hatchery contribution was climbing on us. And so when we got really high, upwards of, I think, 40% in our hatchery contribution, we started getting really worried that our stockings were going to have a negative impact on the fishery. And so we backed off a little bit on that stocking. Actually, we stopped it altogether. And now we're kind of trying to figure out, well, what are the limitations there? And I think that's a real important thing for our listeners to hear, is that stocking's a huge tool. And we stock a lot of fish. We have good hatcheries. We're about to make another one or revamp another one. We stock a lot of trout, we stock a lot of catfish, we stock a lot of stripers. We do a lot of good work with our hatcheries, but it is just but one tool. And sometimes our stocking efforts
can be hurtful.
Yeah, even in the best of intent, sometimes stocking fish is not the solution. And it's important for us to monitor the impacts of our stocking over time to make sure that we're not doing harm instead of good, you know.
Yeah, and I would say the thing about the Roanoke, you know, the American shad being so low, if you look back historically at the Roanoke is, if you look at our four major rivers, Roanoke, Neuse, Tar, and Cape Fear, the Roanoke is probably 2 to 3 times as large of river basin as the other three are. Extends well into Virginia, well into the mountains of Virginia, actually beyond Roanoke, Virginia. And there are historical records of shad making it to Roanoke to spawn, and now they stop at Roanoke Rapids. That's as far as they can get, is Roanoke Rapids Dam. And so I would say, I wasn't around when they made those dams, so I don't know what the habitat looked like, but I would say that a significant portion of American shad spawning habitat has been eliminated by the use of those dams. And so that, I think that has probably the biggest driver, whereas there's dams on the Neuse, the Tar, and the Cape Fear, and they have detrimental effects too, at least for shad and for American shad. They probably don't have quite the effect that it has had on the Roanoke, because the Roanoke spawning grounds are just, there's so much of it, I think, that's gone at this point.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of these dams are getting built on the fall line where there's a big drop, and that's where the fish like to spawn.
Because you hold more water there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's, you know, stripers on the Roanoke may or may not have gone above Roanoke Rapids Dam, but there's significant spawning habitat for stripers below Roanoke Rapids Dam.
Right.
So that makes a little bit of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, every river's a little bit different.
Every river's different.
And that's why the management can vary from river to river. It's not because we're trying to make it more complicated than it needs to be. In fact, I'd love to make it as simple as it needs to be. It's just certain systems dictate things need to be a certain way.
And if you think about their life history, American shad on the Roanoke, those are the Roanoke's fish. The noose and the tar may be similar, but still, even there, the noose fish are noose fish. The tar fish are tar fish.
Absolutely.
The Cape Fear fish are Cape Fear fish. And so you have to manage them differently. They're almost, even though they all go out in the ocean together, they're almost different populations when you think about
them. Once they come into the river, they definitely are.
You know, so it can be tricky to manage for sure.
The other tricky thing about managing them is that we, as an agency, only have purview over them for a brief window in their life. Yeah. You know,
it's an important window.
It is. We get them when they're spawning, which if we don't provide the right place to spawn,
they're going
to
be in trouble.
They're going to be in trouble.
That's
but
right.
Then they go out to the ocean and they're susceptible to any number of pressures. So that's the other thing is basically our job is to make sure that they can spawn successfully.
That's right.
And that there's nothing on the spawning grounds that's getting in their way.
Yeah.
But that may vary river to river. And, you know, we've got locks and dams. We've got fish passage in certain places. We've got a lot of different things that fall into that equation. So, and that's just kind of, I know when folks look at their rules, they go, well, why is it different place to place? And really, that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
So the other thing, and you talked a little bit about water levels earlier, David, where can people find out about water levels? You know, folks are planning trips. Where can they find out? Is it going to be high? Is it going to be low?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So if you just go and Google USGS water gauges, the Geological Survey has gauges along the river, mostly at bridge crossings, that will let you know the flow and the gauge height. And you really do have to use that in the spring. You don't want to show up to the ramp and just see rocks and sand. Or you don't want to see a flood. So you kind of want it in the middle. And like we talked about, these fish are staging up lower river and they're waiting for these flood pulses. And those pulses of flow tell them it's time to go. We're going to go all the way up to Rocky Mount. And so if you want to fish Rocky Mount, just go ahead and check that USGS gauge. There's a gauge at Rocky Mount Mills. It'll let you know the gauge height because, you know, by the end of May, for sure, most of the summer, there's not a whole lot of water up there. And you can maybe get a canoe and a kayak in, but you're not putting a John boat in there. So you want to check the flows, make sure there's enough water, not too much water, because there are a lot of spring floods that happen. Those are good to push fish up there. But you want to check, make sure that water comes down a lot. Last spring was really unique. We got rain once a week last spring. So by the end of the week, our water was getting low and the weekend it would rain. And by Monday, we'd be back up. And you had a couple days in the middle of the week where you had perfect shad flows.
Yeah, tell me about it. It rained every weekend. I know.
It really rained every weekend last spring, which was a gift and a curse.
Yeah. So there's one other thing I want to talk about as far as where we can get information, and that's our weekly fisheries reports. And this year, they're going to be a little bit different. I've already had a few folks email me asking, where's my fishing report? It's not on the webpage like it used to be. It will be on the webpage like it used to be. We're also going to be putting at least one a week on social media, and they're going to be video reports. And so, David, you might get to see and talk about shad. And, you know, they're going to be doing, you know, 30 seconds to 45 minute or 45 second, not minute.
Ooh, 45 minutes. That'd be long.
That'd be a lot. But they're going to do brief. This is what we've seen this week. This is what the water levels look like. This is the kind of any other information they feel is important to share. And the attempt is to try to make it, one, efficient for them because they're going a mile a minute all spring long. And two, to have it in a format that'll be really palatable to the angler where they can just watch a 30-second video and know what they need to know. If they're 30 seconds and you got four rivers, 2 minutes and you know everything that's going on in the coast.
That's right. We're out there every week, so don't feel like you have to be out there every day. If you want to know where and what we're catching, just take a check of those videos. We'll let you know when the shad are coming up river and when we're getting a bunch of striper in our nets and our, not gill nets, but our netting nets. And yeah, we'll let you know where they're at.
Yeah, and pay attention to what they say. I know when I used to do it, they'll give subtle hints about when it's really time to go. Like, if they say something like, now is the time to go, they're probably not joking about that, you know.
They mean it.
Yeah, if you would like to catch a striper, you should go right now. That's a good indication. The other thing is watch your water temperatures and watch those catch rates, because as you start to get to spawning temperatures, that's probably about 15 for shad and about 18 for stripers.
Celsius.
Yeah, that's my fish nerd. I can't remember what it is. I'd have to convert it, but email me at 2BallBiologist and I will have it converted for you.
60, 65.
Yeah.
Yeah, 64 for striper, but shad that are a little bit lower.
Like 62, 63, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. But anyway, once you see those temperatures start to climb into that spawning range, that's another indication that abundance is going to be high. So
that's the peak.
And you can also look at it. And if he says, you know, if you look at last year's video or last week's video, and David says we got 12, and then he says we got 38, and then he says we got 72. I mean, you don't have to read that the fishing's likely getting better along with that as well. So
it ramps up getting into April. You want to get out there at least by April. Once May comes, there can be a May shad pulse that shows up. You're seeing a lot of fish that have been through a lot, and those water temperatures, higher water temperatures, are a little bit rough on them. By mid-May, they're gone.
Yeah. Well, for the most part, or at least we do see fish into June in the rivers. They look like they're in tough shape.
Yeah, they look like they need a break.
They likely are not going back to the Bay of Fundy. They're probably eking their days out.
They're waiting for a flathead to come along and munch on
right. them. But there are, you know, if somebody's listening to this is like, man, I caught one in June. Yes, that does happen. They become more isolated than the rule, though. So this has been great.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
Dave, is there anything else about shad that you feel that folks need to know?
We covered it pretty good. Check those flows. Like we said, it's a really easy fishery to be able to be successful in and have really good days in. So don't be afraid of getting out there just because you don't know what to throw. Like, you can throw a big range of things and you can have really good days. And springtime is a great time. As anglers, we kind of feel like it's that magical time of year. But don't be afraid to get out there.
There you go. Take home. Get out there.
That's right. Go catch fishing. Some fish.
That's right.
Fish need water.
Fish need water.
Don't move fish around.
Yeah, we've hit them all.
Need to make sure we reiterate that. You guys have been great about sending us your questions and your emails, and I have done my level best.
You've done great work. I will say that.
To try to find the people that can give you the best answers.
Yep.
So keep that up. Let us know when you email us if you want to get selected for a prize pack. You know, your address and your t-shirt would be helpful. If not, I'll ask for it if you're the one that's drawn. Let's talk a little bit about our questions. This week, we have one from Mr. Wharton, and he's been fishing in the Durham area, Falls Lake and surrounding areas, Eno, Ellerby Creek.
Oh, so Ellerby Creek.
He'd like to get more into larger size panfish. And one of the things I told him was a lot of that is going to where there's larger size panfish.
He might not be in the right spot.
So I figured while I had some Piedmont biologists in front of me, if you were in the RTP area and you wanted to catch some larger bream, where do you think you'd go?
Well, in general, I'll say that larger size panfish are not known. It's not what the Piedmont's known for. Generally, most of the reservoirs are mid-sized to smaller panfish. And when we're talking panfish, I'm talking bluegills, red ears, red breasts, that kind of stuff. You just generally don't see really large sunfish or panfish populations. In the Durham area, if I was looking for that, Lake Holt out of Butner has a pretty decent red ear sunfish population. It's got stunted bass. And so the stunted bass eat a lot of the panfish. And so the ones that make it are usually really, really good size. If you're looking riverine, I mean, the upper Eno is going to have Roanoke bass, which is a sunfish. It's a decent fish. I mean, a big one is somewhere between 10 and 15 inches. A lot of eights to nines, but you can catch them in the river, but that's all wade fishing. You know, you're going to be standing on the bank. There's a lot of habitat up in the Eno and the upper flat, for that matter, above Lake Mickey to catch Roanoke bass. Another halfway decent spot, and it's not near Durham, is the Yadkin chain is really good for red ears. Tuckertown, Tillery, Baden, has really, really good red ear populations. Strong. Every year we see really nice 3/4 of a pound, a pound and a quarter fish being caught out of there during the spring of the year. So it just really depends. You know, the coastal plain is really known for its sunfish populations. There's quite a bit of decent to large size sunfish in the coastal plain. But as you get into the Piedmont, it tends to limit itself. Another place just came to mind, the Deep River. Deep River has some really nice sunfish in it. It also has Roanoke bass in it as well. There's the Uari River, another good place to catch some decent-sized sunfish. So it just depends. But in the Durham area, I would tell him Lake Holt's the first one I would stick to. You can bank fish there. You can also launch a boat there. It's just north of the town of Butner. It's not far from the prison, if you know where the prison is.
I hope he doesn't know where the prison is.
Well, most people that live in that area know where the federal prison at Butner is.
So the only thing I would add to that is that some of the municipal lakes hop from one to the other.
Yeah.
Because there can be some diamonds in there. And also, if you've got a buddy who's got a house in a development, there can be some real sleepers that can be real good.
I had a guy at church last night. He said to me, he goes, "Hey, I got like really large bluegill in my pond. Would you be interested in fishing?" I was like, "Yes."
Yep. I can help you.
I can help you with that.
I'm specially suited to help you with that problem.
Yeah. Lake Michael, little small tiny lake in Mebane, right outside of Mebane. Another good place for really nice bluegill, especially during the spawn. Really nice bluegill. And like you said, there's other places that I haven't been to, hadn't seen, that are there. Just got to go find them.
Yeah, there's some good opportunities. You just have to kind of, the reservoirs, the place, the big places that you would think about, they may not offer what you're typically looking for.
That's right.
But there's some other options out there. You just kind of got to be willing to kind of think outside the box and look at areas of creative opportunity. There may be a place that's 5 minutes from your house that's loaded with big brim and you just haven't been there yet.
Yeah, so, and nobody else knows it either.
Make sure you have permission to be there.
That's true.
Or, you know, won't work out very well.
Could be a blue light special.
That's right. This is an interesting question we got from Mr. Ross, and he said, "How far do largemouth bass typically travel in a river system for food and shelter, and kind of will they travel further in colder or hot weather months, and will they travel back and forth into and out of the reservoir if there's a tributary that's in there?"
Yeah.
Anybody want that one?
No.
Or am I going to take that one?
You're going to take that one.
So the answer is any number of possibilities.
They do it all.
Largemouth bass in particular are homebodies, but every time we tag, let's say we tag 20 fish to see what their movements are, there'll be 10 of them that are homebodies that may not leave a 100-yard stretch.
Yep.
And there'll be 10 of them that do crazy stuff. There may be one that moves 12 miles a day.
Yep.
And there may be one that just doesn't ever seem to stop and doesn't really have a home range.
Just goes all over the place, circling almost.
But as a general rule, bass are somewhat, if we're going to average all that out, bass are fairly home bodies, but they will respond, especially in a flowing smaller creek like this, they will respond to high and low water.
Yep.
They will respond to warm and cool temperatures, you know, and they're going to try to get in a more preferred zone. So yeah, in the heat of the summertime, they may slide down, get closer to the lake. In the cool of the wintertime, they may do the exact same thing. And then in the spring, they may move up in the creek to spawn or to chase bait or something like that. So it really just depends. But the main thing is, if you're fishing a creek and you're not finding fish, make sure you move.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things we've said before, is if you move, move big. Don't move and fish the same piece of water. Move and fish a different piece of water.
And then once you find them in that habitat, remember what that habitat looks like and try to mimic it where you go next, because that's generally what they do. They kind of pick similar habitats in a river or a creek to be in.
And it really doesn't matter, especially when it comes to bass fishing, something that you can fish for year round. It's not like a shad that's here and gone.
Yeah, that's right.
It takes, in my opinion, if you want to learn an area, it takes about 3 years of hard fishing. What I mean by hard fishing is at least 2 to 3 times a month. I would maybe say hard fishing is once a week or more, but it takes hard fishing over a period of about 3 years before you can really start to predict where these fish are.
Yeah.
That's really at the 3 year mark.
Because you got different flows, different weather variations. You got droughts, you got floods, you got all kinds of stuff to.
That's when those puzzle pieces really start to come together,
right.
And you become more and more proficient. So stay after it, keep fishing, keep figuring out, keep trying new areas. But also, if you caught them there in June and you're not catching them there in November, maybe it's a June spot and you need to kind of think about things that way.
Yep.
So, one more question. We've got a retired couple that is looking for handicap accessible places to fish. And I thought this would be a great time for us to talk about our PFAs and some of the better places to fish in the Hickory area. But let's just talk about it generally too. And David, you want to take this one?
Sure. Yeah, our website's awesome for that.
So our boat ramps, our PFAs are a great place to start. You know, there's other places, but why don't you talk a little bit about those?
We have public fishing areas. That's what PFA is. And you can go to our website and go to your area or go to your water body where you want to fish. And it will show you all the different amenities that they have there, whether it's a pier, bank access, handicap access. You can go and see what you need. And then it'll give you, you know, list the species that you could possibly catch. And if you got further questions, don't be afraid to pick up the phone and call your biologist, because they've been to all of those areas and maybe they can give you a good recommendation on some good spots.
Yeah. Generally, parks, city parks, county parks, municipal parks, they all kind of have some of the same compliance requirements that we have. So those are good places to look. But again, where to fish, there'll be a picture of it. All of our PFAs that I'm aware of have handicap parking. Have handicap accessible fishing.
Where available. They're not always available because of steepness of terrain or something of that nature.
Sure.
But generally, we try to provide ADA compliance to everything that we build, really and truly. If it's available, we build it that way. One, we're required to, but we want to as well. So like the two of you said, just go to our website, go to Where to Fish, look up those sites. It'll definitely say if it's ADA compliant or not. Call your local biologist, ask them, is it a good place to fish or not? Because they'll know.
And I did send these folks to their local contact, yeah. Because those folks are going to know. Like,
exactly.
Hey, you probably need to go. You know, this is where I'd go.
I'd start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If any of you guys are sitting there going, yeah, I looked at that map and I need more information, email us and we'll be happy to put you right in contact with somebody that can help you that.
We got access areas on rivers. We got access areas on reservoirs. We got access areas on small ponds kind of thing all over the state. So
yeah.
There's a plethora of things that you can fish for and places to fish. You just need to go to our website and go to Where to Fish. And if you go to our website and go, I don't understand any of this, contact us at twobaldbiologists at ncwildlife.org, and we will help you in some way or fashion.
We may not understand it either, but
yeah.
We can get you an answer.
That's
you
right.
Need.
We can get you the answer.
Our winner for this month is Brent Pendergrass. I need your address and t-shirt size if you expect to get a pack.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we got a pretty good prize pack. We got different things in it. So got stuff with our logo on it. Stuff without our logo on it. So we got all kinds of things. So we'll be glad to send it to you.
Yeah, send us your questions. You send us a question, we might pick you. You might get some swag out of the deal. So,
yeah.
Well, that's all I have, David. It's been great having you on.
That was awesome.
You've done good. You've done the shad for your area well. Done them proud, so to speak.
Way to represent.
So,
thank y'all for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission's podcast, Better Fishing with Two Bald Biologists. For more information, please visit ncwildlife.org or email us at twobaldbiologists@ncwildlife.org.